дорогим сладким. You're listening to Industrial Evolution, where we're exploring how industrial enterprise leaders can use emerging technologies to stay competitive. I'm your host, Chad Perry, CTO, software engineer, and digital strategy expert, and I'm interviewing the most innovative companies in the world to reveal the future of how we make, grow, move, and power things. These are the pioneers who are shaping the future of manufacturing, agriculture, transportation, energy, and every other industrial sector. In each episode, we're looking at key technologies, state of the market, the challenges of adopting technology into an organization, and success stories of early adopters who have been able to revolutionize their business on the back of these innovations. You can find more episodes and guest information on our website, evolution.industrial.fm. Enjoy the show. Today, we're speaking with John Bruner, head of enterprise strategy for Carbon, the San Francisco-based maker of 3D printers that is grabbing headlines for being the world's first company to offer a fully integrated digital manufacturing platform where product engineers can go all the way to full-scale, high-volume production on the same hardware that they use in prototyping. And that is huge because, as John's going to explain, the world has been waiting for this moment, for truly mass-produced applications of 3D printing beyond the limitations of rapid prototyping. So John is the guy making decisions about how Carbon can best serve their industrial customers. And I'm super excited to have this conversation because there is so much to cover. We're going to be looking at the technical innovations that make Carbon's story possible, as well as who can benefit from these innovations and how to actually adopt this kind of technology into an organization. And we're also going to be looking at some real-world customer transformations that Carbon has enabled. So John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Chad.
So before we get into that, I really have to ask, you have a degree in math and economics with considerable work experience in what you describe as strategic content. So I'd like to know how you even ended up at Carbon in the first place and what exactly your role is there.
Sure. So I started out my career as a journalist. I figured that would be a fun thing to do for a recent college graduate who didn't really know what he wanted to do. It's a great way to ask a lot of questions and learn about a lot of different industries. So I worked for Forbes magazine for about 6 years and wound up doing a lot of programming and writing and using data to create stories. And then I moved over to a technical publisher called O'Reilly Media. And it was there that I learned about the world of hardware and manufacturing, which was really going through a transformation during the time that I was at O'Reilly in the early 2010s. And 3D printing was a big part of that. That was becoming available to individual, designers and engineers, as well as, of course, to hobbyists. And then in 2017, I started working for a different 3D printer company and moved over to Carbon at the end of 2019.
You mentioned 3D printers getting started back in the early 2010s, really the early 2000s is as early as I remember hearing and kind of seeing about this, and there was a lot of excitement around it. But I want to draw your attention specifically to the part of your title that says enterprise strategy, and particularly the enterprise part. So 3D printing is obviously a huge growing field. And a lot of the attention has gone to the consumer side of it, the maker space, the ability to rapid prototyping. And so it's been kind of confined to this consumer grade or, oh, isn't that cute kind of role. So what is it about your role that focuses on the enterprise and why exactly is that necessary?
That's a great question. When a lot of people think of 3D printing, they think of a machine that might be in their kid's school or in the basement of a hobbyist. And one of the big movements that you've seen in the field is the emergence of that consumer 3D printing space. So 3D printing as a technology has been around since the 1980s. And from the time it was introduced up until the early 2010s, it was really strictly an industrial technology. It was very expensive. But then in the early 2010s, there emerged a generation of really inexpensive consumer 3D printers that captured the imagination of the press and of enthusiasts, and we heard a lot about consumer 3D printing. But it turned out that that was kind of overpromised, at least the way that it was presented to the popular imagination. There was this idea that every consumer would have a 3D printer in their home, and that it would replace the Home Depot. And if your knob on your oven breaks, you're going to download a new design for a knob and 3D print it right there in your home. And that vision has not come to fruition, and honestly isn't very close to coming to fruition at any point in our lifetimes. But the same factors that made it possible to put consumer 3D printers on people's desktops have also improved the world of industrial 3D printing. There's been a lot of progress in the hardware and the software and the materials involved in 3D printing. And so the field has just moved forward immeasurably. So the fun thing that's going on is, as you kind of hinted, is that while 3D printing has become ubiquitous as a prototyping technology, and it really is. I mean, it's used to prototype practically every manufactured product at some point. It's still very rare in production to make end-use products. And that's what's changing right now. That's what's really exciting. That's kind of the big thing in the enterprise space, is using 3D printing to produce end-use products, whether those are consumer products or safety products or medical devices or even automotive components. And this is not to say that consumer 3D printing hasn't been great as an educational tool, as a wonderful way for hobbyists and enthusiasts to develop their design skills and understand how things are made. It's been fantastic from that point of view, but it hasn't really changed the way that consumers have products in their home. They're not manufacturing products on 3D printers that they would have bought at a store.
I would suspect that part of that is just the complexity of the process that we'll get more into that has to happen to enable us to have production grade parts from a 3D printer, which actually brings me to my first real question, is this whole movement that has happened. Carbon is at the center of that. Clearly, Carbon is lauded as being the world's first company to offer that truly integrated manufacturing platform where you can go from prototype to full-scale high-volume production. So I'd like to find out a little bit more about what made that possible. When did that get started? I know that Carbon started somewhere around 2013, but obviously this has been in the making for a while. So what is the innovation that Carbon brings to the market?
Carbon, as you said, was founded in 2013, and the first product launched in 2015. And there were two core technical innovations at Carbon. One is a process called clip. So Carbon prints not by the process that's familiar in hobbyist 3D printers, where you take plastic and you heat it and extrude it through a heated nozzle, but rather through a process that's similar to what's called stereolithography, where you use a resin, a liquid plastic resin that's sensitive to UV light, and then you cure it into place using UV light from a projector. That's an overall sort of family of processes that's been around since the 80s. And Carbon came up with an innovation that was published in the journal Science and presented in a TED Talk, where you inject oxygen into the chamber where this curing is happening in order to better control the curing process. So that makes Carbon's process much faster. It also makes it more accurate. It makes it possible to print some shapes that would be difficult to print otherwise. That's innovation number one. It's called CLIP, Continuous Light Interface Production. The other innovation, which is perhaps even more impactful in what we're talking about today, is the development of what we call dual cure materials. So the photopolymers that you conventionally use with a process like this, where they start out as liquid and you cure them into a solid using UV light, tend to be a little brittle. They're kind of, roughly speaking, in the acrylic family. So they kind of feel like acrylic, and they tend to become brittle over time as they're exposed to sunlight and real world conditions. Carbon developed a process where you blend photopolymers with other plastic chemistries, and you cure these materials. They start out as liquids, just like conventional stereolithography materials, and you cure them with projected UV light. And then they come out of the printer and you bake them in an oven. And the baking step takes the secondary plastic and causes that to cure. And in some cases, it transforms the photopolymer into the secondary plastic. In other cases, it burns out the photopolymer and leaves you with a secondary plastic. And what this means is that you can 3D print really phenomenal engineering plastics like polyurethanes, epoxies, cyanate esters. And those previously were not available in 3D printing. And so the development of this type of material and the process for producing it has brought, you know, really high performance plastics into the world of 3D printing. And that's what makes it possible to make all sorts of end use products with 3D printing.
Yeah, and I'm sitting here wondering why not just focused on the materials, because if other 3D printers are doing similar, but obviously not as groundbreaking stereolithography processes, then why not just enable all of the market to be able to take advantage of these materials? What's the decision behind that business model?
Really, it turns out that this field is a total blend of software, hardware, and materials. And for the same reason that Apple feels it's able to deliver the best possible computers and mobile devices by controlling both the hardware and the software, we at Qarbon feel that we're able to deliver the best possible manufacturing results by developing the hardware and the materials and the software that runs the hardware all together as kind of an integrated platform. And we do allow third-party companies to develop materials for the Qarbon platform. And we offer a number of them to our customers, mostly for printing in the dental field. But we've found that this is groundbreaking materials research and that it's essential to understand and be able to tailor the entire platform, the hardware, the software, and the materials for use together.
Because the last thing you want is a bunch of defects or a bunch of parts that are going into production and everybody's really excited about it. And then a couple of years later, it's some sort of critical failure. And then it's like, well, Qarbon's process wasn't that great after all.
You know, there are a lot of subtleties in the 3D printing process in terms of the environment that you create, the heat that you might be adding or taking out of the process, the way that you're, you know, exposing the material to UV light during printing and so on. Even 5 years after our first printer launched, we are constantly tweaking and improving the print process in both our new printers and in our existing printers, because our printers are all internet connected. So we can send new firmware with improved print processes to all of our printers in the field. So if you have a Qarbon printer, you go to bed one night and you wake up the next morning and it's a better printer that prints a little bit faster or a little bit more accurately.
That is really the core of the fourth industrial revolution, is you have this connected ecosystem where you've got material advances, you've got fast computing, but you've got that connectivity so that there is this ultimate continuous improvement and the whole ecosystem benefits. You as the provider benefit, your customers benefit, the downstream users of the products benefit. When you keep talking about stereolithography, I'm drawing parallels here because when you describe this, I've got two separate visions in mind. One where I've seen the picture of Qarbon 3D printers lined up side by side. It almost looks right, like a server room with racks. And then on the other hand, I know what semiconductor fabs have looked like since at least the 90s. And you've got these robots zooming around. You've got these trays of these silicon wafers going into these machines where they're getting washed in these chemicals. So there are some parallels there. How much of this actually came from that and benefited from that?
I'm not sure sort of what the roots of stereolithography are. The semiconductor industry uses a similar one. The difference is that in 3D printing stereolithography, you're building up the material layer by layer, and there isn't kind of an acid wash step in the middle. You've got a model, you've got a build platform that holds the model as you're printing it, and you have a pool of resin below and a projector below that that's projecting the UV light. And as you print, the build platform rises out of the pool of resin. The projector is going below, projecting individual slices onto your model. and your model kind of like emerges from this pool of liquid resin goo. It's very dramatic to watch.
And they kind of look like when they're all side by side, especially in that one iconic photo that I'm thinking of, it looks like an arcade almost where there are all these large cabinets. And I want to get into that a little bit more actually when we talk about your customer transformations, because I'm trying to imagine what that actually looks like, what a deployment actually looks like. We'll come back to that in a minute, but I want to move on to who this is actually for. You've made enormous breakthroughs. The world has been waiting for this. There's obviously an enormous appetite for manufactured goods. And as the world is able to produce more, things will get cheaper. Consumers will be able to consume more. But inside of an organization, we're talking about a wholesale change in how a product is made. What does that look like in an organization that is considering a move to a technology like this, or that may not be considering that, but that is a candidate to use something like this? Like, what are the problems? What are the discussions that they're having that you typically see when they first come to you?
That is a great question. That's the billion-dollar question, is how to bring about kind of a cultural change in the manufacturing world, where engineers and designers and managers are used to using processes like injection molding. And then you introduce, you know, a dramatic new process and invite them to use that. It comes with risks, and it comes with a transformation in design and engineering thinking. So I would divide our customers into a couple of different categories. You have some who are engineers and designers and product managers who have a clean sheet in front of them, and they're able to reimagine their product. And often they're working on a premium product, and they want to find a way to adopt the latest generation of technology and really differentiate it. And so they want to look at 3D printing as a way to manufacture a product that has completely different performance characteristics, completely different aesthetics, a great story behind how it's made. A lot of the examples of 3D printing that you see today kind of fall into that category, where you have a product owner who is able to do something really new. And in a way, that's a little bit of the easier cultural transformation, because you have a group of people within a company who are already interested in trying something new. And they see the new process as being the basis for a premium product. On the other side, you have people who are solving a manufacturing challenge. And the classic manufacturing challenge that 3D printing can solve is that conventional manufacturing processes, especially injection molding, have very high fixed costs and very low marginal costs. So the when you injection mold something, you have a steel, usually it's steel, but sometimes at very low volumes, it can be aluminum mold fabricated with usually electrical discharge machining, which is very slow and high quality and expensive, or with milling. And it can cost anywhere from $5,000 up to $1 million to make one of these molds. And then every plastic part that comes off the mold is very cheap, but you have this big fixed cost up front for the mold and a lot of lead time. So if you're making products that are only going to be made in small volumes, the economics of injection molding are prohibitive. And 3D printing offers an alternative process where there's no upfront fixed cost. You're not making a mold at all. And it is more expensive on a per part basis to 3D print than it is to injection mold. But since you don't have the upfront fixed cost and you don't have the upfront tooling time to make the injection mold, 3D printing can be really economical. So that's an example of the kind of problem that a manufacturing engineer might be looking to solve with 3D printing. There are also things related to, you know, producing parts that that might be very difficult to mold, but that are required for the product. There might be issues that they're trying to solve around distributed manufacturing and having a flexible supply chain that's not centralized in any one place. So that's a bit more of a cultural challenge to address than the first case, where you have people who are trying to do something groundbreaking. Because in this case, you have folks who, you know, have a specific problem on a product that's already underway and they need to solve it. And so whenever they adopt a new manufacturing technology, there's a lot of risk. They need to be reassured that that the new technology is going to meet their requirements, and they need to see some evidence that it has met requirements in other places. So it's, in a way, the consumer 3D printing bubble of about 10 years ago set this part of the 3D printing world back a little bit, because it created a reputation for 3D printing as kind of a trendy fad among hobbyists. And it created this perception that 3D printing wasn't something that could solve real engineering problems. So we've been pushing back on that for a long time now and making good headway. But it is a cultural change to show that 3D printing is a useful tool for the very real problems of, you know, getting plastic parts made on products that need high quality plastic parts.
Yeah, and that's a little bit surprising to hear, because I would think that a manufacturing engineer that is trying to optimize a process, which is on this one end of that spectrum that you described. So they're trying to solve a problem. And it seems like if there's this technology that can do that, it would actually be an easier sell than at the other end of the spectrum, where you have a group of engineers that's just trying to go beyond what's possible and saying, well, we can do new things with our products if we do this. I mean, I understand that a lot of companies do invest in R&D, but when you talk about the digital transformation, a lot of times what you hear is that it is, in fact, a cultural problem, but it's a cultural problem of not being able to support the innovation. So what you're telling me, though, is that you're seeing more of a problem, more of a challenge trying to get this uptake with the people that I would expect to have the most immediate impact on their bottom line, on their cost.
Well, as I mentioned, the manufacturing engineers are very receptive to new technologies that can solve these problems, but they recognize that there's a lot of risk in adopting a new technology here. You might start to go down the road of the new technology for 8 weeks and then discover that you just can't meet that last requirement on mechanical performance or on, you know, solvent stability or something like that. And then you've lost a great deal of time. And at the same time, you know, they're serving functions that are so important that their companies will often not really penalize them for doing things the old way. You don't get in trouble for submitting another PO for, you know, an injection molding tool. That's just what your boss expects you to do. You are responsible for having plastic parts made. They've always been injection molded. And so, you know, here's another part that we're going to injection mold. It's a much bigger risk. You're putting yourself out there much more by suggesting that you use a new technology to do something than you are by saying that you're going to do things by the tried and true proven methods that your company is used to.
Now that's making a lot more sense, because I can see, as a business leader, looking at two various options and saying, look, we know that this 3D printing can be production ready potentially, but we're not willing to risk the core parts of our business on that. So let's go experiment with a new product and see if we can get it to work, versus you've got your main production line. You're absolutely not going to take a big risk trying to do something new there.
Absolutely. And the automotive industry has really figured this out and created processes around the development of new technologies. The auto industry is very interested in using 3D printing in production, but they also have these extremely complex, very sensitive factories. And if you introduce some new technology that isn't fully proven to a production line, and you take the production line down for a day, that costs you millions of dollars. And so they've become very good at kind of separating out their manufacturing R&D processes from the places where they could accidentally do damage. And they've created ways to sort of test these things out at gradually increasing scales to really prove them before introducing them.
Let's just think about two different situations. You've got a group that wants to try new technologies, they want to create features in their product. They want to do something that was previously not possible. And then On the other side, you've got a manufacturing line, an existing product, and it could be made better. So you've got those two different groups. What does it look like? What is that conversation when they first approach you? What do they generally ask?
So to take the new product developers first, often they've seen some really interesting product in a different industry. You know, if they're coming to you from, say, the consumer product space, maybe they saw a really cool medical device that that's manufactured in some novel way using our technology. And they'll come to us and say, you know, here's a product that we're at the beginning of developing. Here's a profile of the consumer. Here's a discussion about the characteristics that we require in the product. Here's, you know, something about a challenge that we've always had with conventional manufacturing that we think we might be able to address. And they typically open a pretty wide-ranging conversation at that point. And Carbon's unique. We have a great applications engineering team that gets involved at the beginning of a lot of these discussions. And so we can begin to create scratch prototypes pretty quickly after one of these companies visits us and discusses their needs. And our team internally can really help them figure out how to use 3D printing to best develop the characteristics that they need in their product. You know, so if they say, my issue is that I need better cushioning in this part of the product and I need the product to be stiffer over here, our applications engineers are expert at designing lattices that can do that for you. And they can take your, you know, your prototype and turn it into a design pretty quickly and begin to discuss at that level.
And that would be a pretty compelling, powerful story, right? It's like, here is your problem solved. Hold it in your hand, which actually brings me to a related question, which is what follows then? Because engineers can get excited about a lot of things and can see the value, but you have an entire value chain of decision makers in an organization that has to sign off on something like that. And then you actually have to introduce the Carbon technology, the platform, the processes around it. So how does that look?
We start to look at manufacturability very early on. So one of the things that people discovered during the consumer 3D printing boom was that 3D printers are not just magic boxes that you can toss a design into and have them produce it flawlessly. You do need to know something about the 3D printing process that you're using in order to get good results from it. And so that's something that our applications engineers think about from the very beginning, is not just getting the best kind of characteristics from 3D printing into the product, but also manufacturability. How do you design the 3D printed component of this product so that it can be produced feasibly and at the cost that the customer needs to see? So when the folks that we start talking to go to their managers, we've got them prepared with estimates for, you know, what it's going to cost to bring their product out and what's involved in terms of a roadmap.
Would that include, I assume, actually acquiring Carbon printers?
There are two ways to work with Carbon. One way is to have one or more of our printers on site at your facility. And Carbon doesn't sell printers. We offer printers on subscription. So you lease a printer and it's at your facility. We support it. We maintain it. We give you regular software updates. We make sure that it's functioning the way that you need it to function. And then the other way to work with Carbon is to send your designs to a partner of ours. We have this network that we call the Carbon Production Network, the CPN. And these are companies that specialize in fabrication from a handful of different angles. We have some companies that are experts in rapid prototyping and product development, other companies that come from an injection molding background, companies from the medical device and dental fields that are able to do production there. These companies have Carbon printers on site, and they can take your design and manufacture it and just send it to you. So you don't need to have a Carbon printer on site in order to work with us. But what we find is that even if you are working with a CPN partner, Carbon's printers are so effective for prototyping that you can really speed up your product development process if you have a Carbon printer in-house that you're using for like nightly product revisions. And then you develop your design that way and send it to a service bureau to get it made when you're ready to scale.
And that's a low risk approach all around. You can subscribe to one of these printers. You don't have to build out an entire room full of them. And then you know that you're going to have your part manufactured on the same platform that it was prototyped on, which is really what the core of the carbon innovation means for a business. And I'd actually like to point out on that note that two other things you mentioned are really part of that Industry 4.0 revolution as well. Mm-hmm. The first is that you are offering what would typically be capital equipment on subscription, and therefore you can offer the upgrades and the data streams and all of that kind of stuff that comes with it. And we're seeing that in things like, I think the last example I saw of that was a Rolls-Royce engine. They actually have a data stream to these engines. And so it becomes more of kind of like a subscription. And the other innovation is the network of production partners that the connectivity enables.
That's right. The connectivity is really cool. We can do predictive maintenance. We can let you know that your printer may need some maintenance before it ever starts to present a problem to you. And the network aspect is just really critical. And this has emerged after the COVID-19 crisis in particular, that everyone is thinking about supply chain resilience. When you have a platform like this with identical printers distributed around the world, and you can develop your product on one printer in-house and then have it made at any company that has a carbon printer anywhere in the world, you wind up with a much more resilient supply chain and a lot more flexibility. The ability to scale your production quickly, the ability to produce where in the world your products are needed and worry less about the logistics of getting them there. I mean, that's a very modern feeling. It's a bit like cloud computing, where you don't need to depend on a server in a server room in your office. You can have your computing done anywhere in the world on demand.
When you're comparing it to the old days of having a server in your office, it's the same idea. If you have your injection mold in your factory, there's only right. one or a handful of instances of that mold. But with carbon printers, these are ubiquitous, or as they become ubiquitous, you have a network around the world. You're suddenly, your risk, your reliance, your dependence, your linchpin, that's gone. And that is right now, that's a significant competitive advantage. Eventually, that will be a competitive baseline, so that if you're dependent on an injection mold, I mean, there will always be specialty devices, right, that can give you a competitive advantage. But in the future, I suspect that we're rapidly moving to a point where if you're not doing this, you're going to find yourself further and further behind.
Yeah, absolutely. You wind up with a rigid supply chain with a pretty difficult cost structure built into it. And now everyone has really internalized the value of having a resilient and flexible supply chain that's able to handle your production and handle changes in your production quickly.
Yeah, and I'd like to go back now to the other type of customer we were talking about, where it's a manufacturing engineer that's trying to optimize a mission critical process on the production line. What does that conversation look like?
Folks in the manufacturing world often have some experience with 3D printing. They're familiar with the promise of it, that, you know, you can cut out the tooling costs, you can manufacture on demand, you can prototype and then produce quickly. And all of that is immensely valuable to manufacturing engineers and manufacturing managers. What they really need, though, is the assurance that a manufacturing process is going to get them the characteristics that they require, because there's already been a lengthy design process involving, you know, designers and engineers and manufacturing managers to design a product and characterize it and understand how it'll be made. And if you start to substitute a new manufacturing process in, it has to meet the expectations that have been baked into the product from the beginning. And that may be from, you know, years ago or decades ago in the case of really long running products. So for this crowd, what's really important is a reassurance that this new technology is going to meet their needs. And we have a lot of testing. You know, we have these high quality engineering materials. We have an entire team that does nothing but work on the print process, characterize the results, measure everything, provide really detailed data sheets, so that we can go in and have conversations with manufacturing folks and say, look, we're able to reassure you that, you know, a print made with our RPU 130 material, which is rigid polyurethane, is going to perform exactly this way. And this also comes down to our applications engineering team, where we have experts, you know, take a look at your problem, take a look at the part that you're making, understand how it can be produced on a 3D printer, and then help you know kind of what to expect.
So do you ever run into the situation where I'm kind of imagining this like a little kid. So for either of these customer groups, the customer's engineering team has come to you, you've proven that you have the capabilities and that this is actually going to be beneficial to the business, and everybody is really excited about it. And so off they go, they take their reports and everything that you prepare them with to the executive management team, and the executives just say no. What are the actual objections that come up?
So there are a few different perspectives within the executive and management teams that you often find. I think actually the top level executives are very supportive of this kind of innovation in general. CTOs and heads of manufacturing, heads of R&D and so on are really steeped in this idea that you need to keep innovating, you need to develop new processes, you need to improve the way that you go about running your business. And so in the abstract, executives are quite supportive of experimenting with 3D printing to do new things. I think for managers in kind of the middle layers who are responsible for operations, there can be some cultural resistance to trying out new things. Because after all, if you're responsible for running a plant and your engineers bring in a new technology and it fails in some way and brings down your production line, then that's your problem as the operations manager for the plant. And meanwhile, no one is really giving you a hard time for running the plant the way that it's always been run, with incremental improvements here and there. So it's kind of that middle layer of management that tends to experience the risk in taking on new technologies a little bit more. What we offer them is, you know, first of all, the Carbon platform, our printers, when you install them on site, are a dream for operational managers. They're all networked, and we offer software at several different layers for managing these printers, for managing your fleet of 3D printers, for managing queues of jobs that go into your printers, for understanding how your employees need to be distributed to operate them. So we make it very not only easy to have these printers on site and easy to maintain them and so on, but we give operations managers a lot of control and a lot of insight into how these printers are being used. I think they're smarter than just about any other equipment that you would have on your factory floor. And that provides a lot of reassurance for operations managers. And then the other option, if installing a 3D printer on your plant floor isn't an option, you know, we can support customers in setting up 3D printing operations elsewhere, or of course we can facilitate the production of your product at one of our CPN partners, so that, you know, the 3D printing isn't even happening in the customer's manufacturing environment. They're able to enjoy a lot of the benefits of 3D printing, but without the risk of introducing a new technology into their plant floor.
Yeah, and you mentioned the middle management kind of aversion to that risk taking. And that actually makes a lot of sense to me. That's something I hear a lot in these interviews, is that there's this idea that we all know that there has to be innovation, but the person who is going to take the fall if it goes wrong, and especially if they're going to take the fall in isolation, that person has to be empowered to be able to take that risk without fear of retribution, and understanding that failure is part of the learning process. And obviously you don't want to fail on your production line, right? You don't want to shut down your entire production line. That's the wrong kind of fail.
Yeah, you need to have safe places to experiment.
Is your model set up so that you can actually start small and kind of do this as an experiment?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the smallest way to start is to not even have a printer on site, to work with one of our CPN partners like Fast Radius or TTH or Proto Labs. And you just take your part file and you send it to them on the internet, and they ship you a box a couple days later with a 3D printed part in it that's made on a Carbon printer. No risk whatsoever to your processes. And then it's very easy to scale. I mean, these scale linearly in a factory environment. You start out with one printer and one smart part washer and one oven, and you can just keep on adding printers going down the row and increase your capacity. So we see that in particular at our CPN partners, where, you know, a lot of these companies might have a history as, you know, an injection molding house, and they want to get into a new technology. So they install one Carbon printer. They find that demand is good and they want to expand it. So they wind up adding two Carbon printers a year as they go and ratchet up their capacity.
You guys are just laying the groundwork for rapid innovation across the industry. And that actually brings us to the third point that I really wanted to touch on in this conversation, and that is some of the customer transformations that you've enabled. Specifically, now that we've been talking about how to get started and you can scale up from prototyping, from a small test, from a single printer, from a bureau to massive scale, let's talk about a couple of different success stories. Now, I know you've mentioned a few, so I'm just going to let you start wherever you want to start.
Yeah, so I'll start with the product that just started shipping to customers a few weeks ago. This is a bike saddle from Specialized, whose bikes you might be familiar with. So it's called the S-Works Power Saddle with Mirror Technology. It's a bike seat, and instead of foam, which is inside conventional bike seats, the padding is made from a 3D printed elastomeric lattice. It looks kind of like a 3D honeycomb pattern inside the saddle. And there are two really cool things about this. First of all, this is data-driven design. We have software that designs lattices, and that's cool in itself. But Specialized, having been experts in developing bikes for decades now, has decades of data on how bike riders sit on their saddles. And they were able to pass that over to our engineering team, which used our lattice design software to create a lattice for this bike seat that gives you rigidity and support where you need rigidity and support, right where your sit bones, you know, come in contact with the saddle, and that is soft and pliant where you want the bike seat to be soft, which is to say, you know, where your bones are not in contact with the bike seat. So the result is both futuristic looking and incredibly comfortable. And it's the result of, and you can think of it as data-driven industrial design, which is a field that's just emerging now and is really cool.
The aesthetic of it is really part of it, because I have the picture of this thing up and I just want to say it looks incredible. It looks like nothing else I've seen. You know, I'm used to riding on a leather Brooks saddle, right? I mean, those are old school traditional. And then you also see the ones that are kind of foam that's covered with some sort of plastic layer. But this thing looks right. Like it was designed by SpaceX and they're going to launch it into space. So yeah. Let's talk about that for a minute, because there's another example of a product, the football helmet, that we can also talk about. But both of these things demonstrate the new aesthetic of the future, which is driven by function. But it's kind of like the marker of being in the future, because this was not possible without this manufacturing process.
Exactly. It requires not only this manufacturing process, but also some pretty significant software chops. And that's something that Carbon has also developed in parallel with the hardware and the materials. In the case of the bike seat, that's the result of decades worth of data that Specialized has gathered, as I mentioned. In the case of the Riddell football helmet, the Riddell SpeedFlex Precision Diamond helmet that you mentioned, this is a football helmet for professional, you know, NFL players that uses a 3D printed lattice helmet liner to protect them as they play football. And that lattice is actually generated as a custom design for every player. So every player gets his head scanned, and then the scan data goes into our software, which simulates the design of the lattice across more than 1,000 different dimensions. And it winds up developing a customized lattice with 140,000 different individual struts in it. And that lattice offers both protection and, you know, and performance and comfort. So it's a really cool area where it's what we call inverse design. Not only does it look cool, but this field allows designers and engineers to specify their requirements, and then the software fills in the design to meet the requirements. It's the opposite way from the regular way of designing stuff, where you have requirements in mind, a human creates a design, tests it with finite element analysis, goes back and revises the design. So this is the opposite way. The human puts in the requirements, the software comes up with the design.
Yeah, and that brings us back to the competitive advantage aspect of it, because you have a couple of different things there. One is, if you're able to create a custom design based on inputs that can go into software and come out as a product that is tailored to a specific consumer, then you have the ability to offer something that nobody else has. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you can do it faster. So I believe that you mentioned Specialized had done this in some sort of record-breaking amount of time compared to what they normally do. So what was their design process like for this?
Yeah, that's the essential thing for all of these companies, is that 3D printing not only allowed them to develop a better product, but it allowed them to develop a better product in much less time and at less cost. So when Specialized goes out to develop a new bike saddle, typically it's a 2-year product development process with conventional materials and conventional designs. In this case, the S-Works power saddle with mirror was developed in 10 months. So it went from 2 years to 10 months of product development time. And in the 10 months, they went through 80 different design cycles. So this is a great illustration of how you kind of tie these new modes of design, these new design processes, to new manufacturing processes, and everything gets faster. The design team could tweak the design of the bike saddle in the afternoon, have it print overnight, and then have a new saddle to look at in their conference room the next morning.
This is something that the strategic leaders in an organization need to be very, very aware of, is that not only are we talking about cost savings here, but we're talking about the ability of potentially small upstarts, as well as larger companies who are already taking this seriously, to come out with products at a much faster rate than what they're used to. And as we've seen over the last 2 decades or so with technology, that can spell disaster for an entrenched organization that thinks they own the market.
Yeah, exactly. This is a real transformation of the product development process for companies like Specialized and Riddell that are already experts in the design of the kinds of products that they manufacture. It's an opportunity to advance their lead even further and use their expertise to create a new generation of products. And for companies that are trying something new, it's an opportunity to leapfrog the incumbents who have longer, slower product development processes and come up with a superior product that does something truly new in a lot less time.
We've been talking about the bicycle seats, the football helmets, and I would say especially for football helmets, but even for the bicycle seats, these could arguably be lower production runs. People could say, well, that's not truly a large scale volume production. So I want to look at one more example, and that is that these crazy shoes that Adidas made, and by the way, it looked like Adidas actually was one of your primary investors in your last round. So clearly they take this very seriously. So what are these 4D shoes?
Yeah, so Adidas is both an investor and a valued customer of ours. They have this line of shoes called the Futurecraft 4D shoes that have 3D printed midsoles. So that's the part of the shoe that's, you know, below the fabric upper and right above the kind of rubber layer that hits the ground. These are really striking shoes visually. They are immediately different. When you look at them, you're like, wow, those are the space shoes of the future. And they're beautiful, and they're really striking. They're also extremely comfortable because Adidas developed a design for the lattice midsole in their shoes that reflects, you know, what you would want in a shoe. So when you're making a shoe with a conventional foam midsole, it's pretty tough to tune the response of the foam. You often wind up with your heel goes into the foam, it squishes the foam a little bit, and then it sort of bottoms out in the foam and you hit a hard stop. that's the source of a lot of discomfort in athletic shoes. Foams tend to degrade. They lose their springiness and cushion after a while. Adidas took its knowledge of athletic shoe design and was really able to open up a new domain in shoe design and address a lot of the shortcomings of foam by developing a 3D printable lattice midsole. So the Adidas midsoles, the Futurecraft 4D shoes, are probably the highest volume end-use 3D printed products out on the market today. They were really notable, especially when they launched, but still, as an example of 3D printing at scale. Before Adidas developed those shoes, there were not really examples of end-use 3D printed products going out in those numbers.
I have the Adidas website up here. I'm looking at a replay video on their main page, on their splash page, that shows these shoes. What's immediately striking about it is that we're talking about a 3D printed part here. I have this, and probably a lot of engineers have this leftover mindset of 3D parts as brittle, rigid structures. Mm-hmm. This is something that is bending and flexing. It's bending and flexing in a way that looks extremely organic, which is probably why, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, they're extremely comfortable. And so that's what's so striking about this, is this really demonstrates the age that we're moving into. We're no longer talking about a 3D printed cog or a gear or something like that that's hidden out of sight. We're talking about something that is open to the public sight. We're talking about something that performs entirely differently. So we really are experiencing an evolution that is powered by these new materials, by this new process.
I've handled a lot of 3D printed parts, and I'm accustomed to handling them gently because you expect them to be sort of brittle or fragile. This material, that the Adidas midsoles are made out of a carbon material called EPU-41. It's an elastomeric polyurethane. I have some parts on my desk right now that I kind of use as stress toys, you know, during the day when I'm on the phone or something. And this material is practically indestructible. I've gradually become more demanding on it in the way that I, you know, bend it in my hand. You expect it to break. It doesn't break. These midsoles last longer than conventional foam. I mean, you can wear these shoes for years and they perform just as well as they did when they were fresh out of the box.
For somebody who is an engineer or an executive decision maker, middle manager, anywhere in this value chain who sees the potential of this and wants to get started and take that next step, what do they need to do?
The best place to start is at carbon3d.com. We have a lot of information about our process. We have design guidelines that you can read through and use to help you to start to create a design that's ideally suited to carbon's digital light synthesis process. And then after that, the best place to start is with a conversation with our team. So you can contact us through our website. You can also just send me an email. I'm at jbruner@carbon3d.com, and I'll make sure that you get connected with the right team at Carbon. But the process, the technology is available to anyone. It's really easy to get started. You don't need a printer in your factory, though you'll want one once you experiment with it. You can just start with a design file and send it to one of our partners for production. So it's an amazing technology, totally transformative. Can't wait to see what your listeners do with it.
This is obviously, you guys started in 2013. There are a lot of really interesting innovations happening, but we're finally getting to see the result of that. And I just can't wait to see where you guys go. I know that you just recently got another huge round of funding. So obviously there's a lot of belief in what you're doing. Obviously your customers believe in it, and I'm excited to see where you go. So John, thank you so much for joining us. Definitely look forward to staying in touch with you and seeing where you guys go.
Appreciate the chance to talk.